Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Rachel Iacovone. For this part of the hour, we're talking about the sexual assault of a minor, a child by legal and societal definitions of the word. We've talked about sexual assault generally before. The entire nation seems to be talking about it with the rise of the Me Too movement. But today we're talking with a young survivor who was assaulted when she was only 15. If you think that's uncommon, you may be surprised to hear the latest numbers show nearly 1 in 5 girls between the ages of 14 and 17 have been the victim of completed or attempted sexual assault. In a typical high school class of about 20 kids, half of which are probably girls, statistically speaking, 2 of them have been assaulted. So today's show may be best to sit down and listen to later, together, when you can have these conversations with your daughters and with your sons as a family. Gulf Coast Live is available wherever you get your podcasts or just after the show at gulfcoastlive.org. Turning now to our guests who have been patiently waiting, Chessie Prout is a recent graduate of Community School of Naples and the young woman I mentioned earlier. Hi, Chessie. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Chessie's taken her survival story to the page in her memoir, I Have the Right To, a high school survivor's story of sexual assault, justice, and hope. The book was written with the help of Jen Abelson, who is a reporter on the Boston Globe Spotlight team. She joins us now. Thank you for talking with us, Jen.
Thanks for having me.
I'm speaking with Chessie Prout, the author of the memoir, I Have the Right To, and her co-author, Jen Abelson, who is a reporter for the Boston Globe Spotlight team. You can join the conversation, too. We're on Facebook at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, tweet at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. Chessie, I'm sure this question never gets easier, but can you tell us what happened to you while attending St. Paul's School in New Hampshire?
Well, I started attending St. Paul's School in New Hampshire my freshman year of high school. And I was 14 years old when I started there. At the end of my freshman year of high school, when I was 15, I was sexually assaulted as a part of a Sikh sort of tradition at the school called the Senior Salute.
In the immediate aftermath, it's a chapter in your book, you kind of detail your confusion about what just happened to you, your friends' horrified reactions, and eventually you speaking to the dorm advisor after she heard you screaming over a frustrating text from a supposed friend. You describe the conversation with the dorm advisor as using hypotheticals, as you were taught at orientation. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Right. So to protect the students, I guess, and to protect the school from having to take any action, I think the teachers told us to talk to them in hypotheticals as to not incriminate ourselves or others. And so I just spoke like that, trying to protect whoever, and trying to be as easygoing as possible by saying that. And my advisor told me that I should probably call my mother. But one of the things that bothered me the most about the days following my assault was that I didn't know that what happened to me was against the law. As you said before, I mean, the only way I could say and describe what had happened to me was that somebody had sex with me and I didn't want it. But the reason why I've come forward and written this book and have been so outspoken about this is that I want other people, young and old, to realize that this is not our faults and that we have the right to use our voice and to call it what it is, which is sexual assault or rape.
Do you think other survivors outside of St. Paul's School use hypotheticals and kind of what you're saying, the refusal to maybe use the word rape when they're first reporting their assault?
I can only speak to my own experience, but in my own case, I mean, it took me a couple months to even say the R word. I couldn't even associate that word with myself without feeling so incredibly hopeless and helpless. But I think it's so important to remember that this is an action taken by somebody else against us, but it doesn't make us all weak. It doesn't make us all vulnerable all the time. We can find strength and power through our weaknesses and kind of come out the other side knowing that we are strong and we are able to weather this fight.
And that was another question I had for you. At 15 years old, where did you find that strength to tell the right people to get you help in the first place?
I found a lot of that strength through my family, my close family and extended family. My parents were so extremely supportive of me and my process of coming forward and talking to detectives. And they even moved countries back from Hong Kong back to Naples, Florida to help me through the legal process. My dad lost his job in the process because he took time off to take care of me. And my little sister and mother had to move countries and start at CSN again. But this community school sort of community also welcomed me back with open arms when I left St. Paul's School in 2014.
Were you attending community school when you ended up going to trial?
I was, yes.
So you went through with the trial, and I guess I have to ask, how did you find that even a couple years later? You're a little older, but you're still a teenager, a child by legal definition. How did you find the strength to deal with the media coverage and the commenters all across the internet?
Right. So when the trial started, it actually started on the first day of my junior year of high school at CSN. And so I missed the first 2 weeks of my junior year and missed all of my assignments, thought I could keep up with them during the trial, but I was not prepared for how much of a bully the defense attorney would be and how taxing it would be on my body physically and emotionally to be there every day in Concord, New Hampshire. So I was behind on all my work, but I was lucky enough to have my teachers, respect and support in giving me extensions and, and the support of my family and extended family there also helped a lot.
And at the end of the trial, of course, Owen LaBrie was acquitted of the felony sexual assault charges, but was convicted of 3 counts of misdemeanor sexual assault charges. Is that a win for you?
There is no win in this sort of situation. I mean, people would ask after, are you happy with this outcome? Are you happy that it ended this way? I mean, I'm not happy because this happened to me in the first place. No matter what, that's no sort of verdict or punishment is ever going to take that away from me, take my pain away from me. So I was glad that it was over with, and I hoped that by shedding the light on the culture at St. Paul's and what led to my assault in the first place would help kids going forward there.
I was just going to jump in to say that when Owen broke his bail, he ended up having to go to jail for a period of time, and he's now on an ankle monitoring bracelet. So he is, he is constantly at this moment being watched. But I do think when he did break the conditions of his release, it was very scary for Chessie and her family to see that he had violated his curfew a number of times. And he is also, just so you know, he was convicted of a felony computer charge for luring a minor for sex, and so he is a registered sex offender.
I'm speaking with Chessie Prout, the author of the memoir I Have the Right To, and her co-author, Jen Abelson, who is a reporter for the Boston Globe Spotlight team. You can join the conversation, too. We're on Facebook at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, tweet at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. Chessie, by law, you remained anonymous during the trial, but that's clearly not true now. So what made you come forward publicly?
Well, the 2 days kind of following the trial and the verdict, these websites started popping up online. Somebody had commented my name underneath a news article online, and hate sites popped up everywhere where people could write these terrible, awful, disgusting narratives about who I was and what happened to me. And they would write death threats and rape threats, and even showed my family's home, our address, our phone numbers, pictures of my younger sister, pictures of my friends, which was so disgusting and violating. If you searched my name on the internet, that's what you would see. You would see Chessie Prout, the St. Paul school slut. So I wasn't really given the gift of anonymity through this process. I was blasted on the internet and was written about, and that was horrible. So when St. Paul's school challenged my anonymity in a court filing, I knew it was my time to step up and come forward and reclaim my name and reclaim my story.
And how have people responded since then, now that besides those hate sites, they have the face and a name that might match their own, you know, other young women?
By coming forward, I really wanted to show the humanity, show the human behind the word, either survivor or victim. And so I hoped that other people could see my face and realize, well, I could be their daughter, I could be their sister, I could be their friend. Statistically speaking, this happens to way too many people in the U.S., and that's knowing that this is the most underreported crime in the U.S. So I really thought that it would be important for me to get my story out there and show people what it's like for at least one sexual assault survivor.
Are there ever moments when you regret going public?
This journey definitely was not easy, and it was not a quick and fast decision for me to come forward. There are so many things that are discouraging to me every day, but with the up-and-coming rising of the Me Too movement finally catching fire and the Time's Up movement, I'm encouraged that there's more public support of survivors and victims around the globe.
And turning to you now, Jen, St. Paul's School has repeatedly denied that a senior salute culture exists, but we're going to say it does, or at least did, based on Chessie's own experience and the many other students she speaks with throughout the book. So, Jen, in your investigative work with The Globe, you actually reported on sexual misconduct at several New England private schools. Are there comparisons to be made in the cultures of those institutions with the one at St. Paul's?
Absolutely. I spent a year in 2016 with my colleagues investigating sexual misconduct at private schools across New England, and we looked at dozens of schools and found hundreds of victims spanning over decades. And we found horrific abuse of boys, but we also found widespread entitlement and misogyny that led to the abuse of vulnerable girls as well. We saw things that were games. We saw horrific student-to-student abuse. We also saw teacher-to-student misconduct. And it was just this very insular world of privilege and elitism, and there was very little scrutiny from the outside.
Has your reporting, and then your co-authoring now, illuminated for you any way these systems can be fixed?
I think there was often an unwillingness to acknowledge wrongdoings that happened on campus and to find ways to address them and find ways to create a healthy and safe learning environment for students. When we were working on our investigation, St. Paul's School refused to participate, and they accidentally forwarded an internal email that said, "We want to be polite, but we don't want to add anything new to the conversation." And I feel like that really reflected the attitude of a lot of these schools, which was silence and denial. Our investigation did prompt dozens of schools to launch their own independent investigations. And so they've been forced, essentially by the shame that they often inflicted on the victims, but they've been forced to confront their secrets and their history and try to create, you know, more support for survivors and to create healthier learning environments.
Was it through this reporting that you first heard about Chessie's story?
Chessie's had testified a year before our investigation began, and so I had long admired her from afar. I was in awe of her strength, and she did the kind of work that I try to do every day, which is to expose wrongdoings and hold institutions accountable. And you know, her willingness as a teenager to step up against a 160-year-old institution was mind-blowing, and her poise and her grace were just astounding. And so it was a real privilege to get to know Chessie. We connected in the summer of 2016, right before she decided to go public on the Today Show and break her silence. So I've watched her transition from more of a private victim into this incredibly powerful public advocate.
When you first started talking, was there already talk of a memoir? How did you guys decide that?
It was a conversation we had over several months. I saw Chessie as she was participating in her advocacy work and showing up to different schools and talking to students. And we talked about, you know, whether this was the right thing for her. As I dug through her story and the public records that were out there, it was very clear to me that there was so much more to tell. There had been widespread coverage of her trial, but very little in-depth reporting on the real school's culture, the betrayal and hostility that Chessie faced after she was a victim, the way everyone turned their backs on her, how the school's, one of her friend's fathers fundraised for her perpetrator for his defense and hired a mobster attorney. It was truly, you know, horrifying what happened to her. And so together we talked about whether this was the right thing for her. And eventually Chessie felt like that she wanted to share her story and help other people.
So you were a Pulitzer Prize finalist a couple years ago, and I myself am a reporter, obviously, so I hope you know I mean absolutely no offense when I ask you, but how did you take those cut-and-dry journalistic writing skills and apply them to this narrative format? It reads almost like a good fiction novel, despite the all-too-real story behind it.
Well, I was so deeply impressed as a reporter with Chessie and the way that she documented her journey. I was incredibly lucky that she allowed me into her journal. She gave me her journal, her diary, her college application essays, her high school essays, her text messages, Facebook messages. Sort of we really dug into all of her personal material and pulled a tremendous amount of information from court filings, police reports. And so as you can hear Chessie in this conversation, she is an incredibly strong, poignant voice. And sometimes we would just have conversations and I would transcribe our conversations and just literally transplant them onto the page.
Wow. So very detailed conversations for sure then, just having read the book.
Mm-hmm.
So Chessie, one of the most disturbing parts of I Have a Right To's play-by-play of the events was that the text was littered with the messages from Owen, who continued to reach out after assaulting you. why did you decide to take the reader through each of those interactions with him?
Well, it was something that was really emphasized during the trial, and that's emphasized in a lot of cases involving sexual assault that happens from somebody that you know and trust. And so I felt like it was important to show what was actually going on behind the scenes of those messages, the pressuring I was getting from my friends to stay nice, to find out information for my own personal safety and health, things that no 15-year-old girl should ever have to ask about, worrying about being pregnant or having any STIs. And so I wanted to show that and show my voice and my mindset behind those. And again, showing all of these through these first available sources, the main source, was very important to me because during the trial, my words were taken and twisted and molded into whatever the defense wanted it to be. And so I wanted to make sure that my words were represented accurately in the book, but also that everybody else's words were represented accurately. So a lot of the book, the events that transpired, we pulled from dates and text messages that we can piece together to actually know that, that these things happened at that exact time.
In your own words, you had admitted you didn't kick or scream or fight back during the assault, but you'd already said no more than once, and then you eventually just froze. How you initially responded to Owen's message is curt, courteous. Is that just an extension of that freezing up?
Absolutely. I think it's a very valid response that survivors might have after an interaction, after an assault with somebody that they know. And also, I was trying to get, again, information that would be pertinent to finding out if I was okay physically, if I was safe from pregnancy, from STDs. And so that's what those messages kind of meant.
And with the rise of the Me Too movement, like you mentioned, we're hearing a lot more adult women and men who froze too. And though there's been less, what is she wearing and why was she flirting with him if she didn't want that to happen, the response has still been, why didn't she fight back her hardest and why didn't she scream at the top of her lungs? I guess I'm asking, what questions should the public be asking survivors instead?
A lot of times these questions that people ask survivors in the aftermath can be sort of out of goodwill. They want to find out information, but they're inadvertently victim blaming. So I would think that I would hope that people would take the time to research and learn about what happens to a survivor's mind after the trauma and what freezing actually means to a survivor and how that can lead to disassociation in the future and future mental health issues. But understanding where we're coming from and understanding and listening to our stories, listen to us when we talk, support us, believe us, that's the response that we need instead of grilling us for small details that might be hazy in our memory because we've just gone through a huge trauma.
Jen, the argument can be made that we in the media play into that role, or we did or we still are, a large role of the victim-blaming rape culture. So in your reporting for the Spotlight piece on sexual misconduct at those schools, or now co-authoring I Have the Right To, how did you combat falling into the trap of rape culture in the media?
I think the media and its role was a really interesting part of working on this book with Chessie. She talked a lot about the comments that often end up below stories that we write on sexual assault that all media writes. The comments are often targeting the girls, blaming the girls, and sort of lauding these boys as these, you know, wonderful boys with so much to lose. And so I had never really thought about I'd always seen the comments and they'd made me sick, but I didn't really think of it necessarily from like a survivor's perspective. And similarly, I think part of why Chessie came forward and why we spent a lot of time on her interactions with the media and sort of the role that it played in her speaking out eventually was that so much of the mainstream media narratives around rape cases do sort of talk about the perpetrators, like her perpetrator was this Harvard-bound scholar, athlete, soccer captain, accepted to all these Ivies, and there's a full, colorful, robust description of this youth and what his bright future is, whereas the victims are very little time and space is given to them. And so I do think that there's an opportunity for the media to spend more time or at least balance out how they describe the victim and the perpetrator. In Chessie's case, there was a Vanity Fair story where she was described as the most description she ever got, but they were you know, very sort of this very old school kind of rape culture narrative of she was confused and flummoxed and competitive with her sister. And so it painted her into this naive teenager who didn't really know what she was doing.
And so how do journalists avoid having opinionated statements like that when, in her own words, Chessie, you had said you were confused? How do we properly cover things like this?
I mean, I do think it's a matter of, in some cases, balancing the amount of time that's spent on the victim as well as on the perpetrator in terms of space devoted. I also think it's just better understanding the narrative of how these cases happen and understanding how sexual assault happens. So often there is, like, the defense attorneys will spend a lot of time on asking about the grooming habits. What were they wearing? What was the underwear, the clothes? Whereas the questions that the reporters and others should be asking is, well, why did this person allegedly commit this crime? What was going on? What were they doing? So I think that there's, you know, rather than spending so much time challenging and questioning the victim, I think equal amount of time should be challenging and questioning the perpetrator.
I'm speaking with Chessie Prout, the author of the memoir, I Have the Right To, and her co-author, Jen Abelson, who is a reporter for the Boston Globe Spotlight team. You can join the conversation, too. We're on Facebook at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, tweet at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. On the back cover of the book, it says, I have the right to, followed by a list of things survivors have the rights to or should have the rights to, including to be called a survivor, not an alleged victim or accuser. Chessie, I'll start with you. This isn't an easy question, but one people seem to always ask about this subject. Couldn't someone be accusing an innocent person of raping them?
That's an interesting area. I know a lot of people like to bring up the fact that the false reporting rate is maybe 2 to 6%, but people forget to mention that that is also including the victims and survivors who have to drop charges either for monetary purposes or for threatening purposes. So again, I try to focus on believing the survivor and talking to them. That's my area of work, because obviously if something's going on there, something wrong is happening. And so it's important that we pay attention to survivors and listen and hear their stories to fully understand what they're going through.
And our legal system, of course, is set up so that a person is innocent until proven guilty. But would the argument then be survivor stories are proof enough of guilt that we shouldn't wait for a court conviction to believe them?
Well, obviously, I'm not an attorney. I haven't even started college yet. But in the stuff that I do, the work that I do, I work on these things through interpersonal relationships. So I talk with people. I sympathize with them. I know their pain sometimes. I can understand their pain. And I think just too often we're thrown aside and forgotten about and called liars right off the bat. So, again, I think there needs to be more equality in the system for victims versus perpetrators. And New Hampshire has started doing something along the lines of that with proposing a new constitutional amendment called Marcy's Law, which would allow the victim at least equal rights to the perpetrator.
And you've mentioned your advocacy work a couple times now. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yes. Well, it's something that I kind of love and hate to do. It's really, really rewarding to get to meet all these different people, young and old, and hear their stories, talk to them, and help give them hope in this process and have them give me hope through this process. But it is difficult sometimes to hear these stories and not be able to do anything about it. That can lead to feeling hopeless and helpless again. But I hope that by going around and talking to different students, talking to parents, talking to administrators, that I can help change this sort of rape culture that exists in our schools and start to create a consent culture that will help create a supportive environment for survivors and help them feel comfortable in coming forward.
And you'll be attending Bernard in the fall. For those who don't know, Bernard is the prestigious women's college at Columbia University. So are you studying English by chance after becoming a successful author?
I am actually undecided right now.
Plenty of time to decide, right?
Yes, yeah.
Can we expect any more works from you in the future? It sounds like you were very meticulous in your writing, at least.
Well, yes. I know that my advocacy work and all this sort of work that I do will show through anything I do in the future. I love writing. I love music. I love theater. And I love the way that we can purvey different values and ideas through theater and art. So I'm excited to be in New York City next year to be able to continue with that. But I know that my advocacy will extend to any area of work, and it should extend to any area of work. Like, my father is I get to go now to different areas in Asia where my dad works, and I speak to different bankers and investment groups about sexual assault and how to support survivors, whether it be their children or their colleagues.
Wow. Already, and you're so young, right?
Yes.
And so, Jen, does that mean that you'll be co-authoring or at least sponsoring her in all these efforts in the future?
Chessie and I are linked at the hip for the rest of our lives, and I'm very excited about that.
And I wanted to close with a little bit of time we have with talking about how hope is right there in the subtitle of the book. And so what is it that you, Chessie, but also you, Jen, what are you hoping people get from reading I Have the Right To?
Well, I hope that people just see the basic humanity behind the word survivor or victim and realize that their words matter, that sexual assault is a crime that oftentimes you don't see the scars on the outside. So you never know who's hurting from what. And so I like to live my life now meeting everybody with sympathy and compassion, although it is trying at times, and I do have a lot of anger in my heart about different things. But I've learned that treating people with basic kindness and respect is so incredibly important. And to have kids learn that from a really young age is perfect in the discussion of talking about consent and teaching consent.
I'm just hopeful that this book sparks conversations. This is not a book just for girls and their mothers and sisters. This is for, you know, sons and men and uncles and dads. And we want everyone to read this and to take away the learning and understanding of how to better treat survivors and be someone who can be supportive in the community. And we've been so excited touring the country and talking to students in schools and going to bookstores and spreading these conversations around consent and healthy relationships.
Well, that is all the time we have. I'd like to thank my guest, Chessie Prout. She's a 19-year-old sexual assault survivor with a recently released memoir on her experience then and since. She went on to graduate from Community School of Naples. Her memoir is called I Have the Right To and was co-authored by Jen Abelson, a reporter on Boston Globe's Spotlight team. Thank you both for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Our show today was produced by Mike Canary and yours truly. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Rachel Iacovone. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.